So the Break Free from Plastic Coalition recently sent a letter to Congress outlining stimulus recommendations to address plastic pollution. That letter was signed by 257 groups, including Valley Improvement Projects. And we're here with Thomas Helm, who is the co-founder and director of Valley Improvement Projects. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So this letter has some recommendations around environmental justice issues that have to do with incinerating plastic waste. Can you tell us what your experience is with this issue?
Yeah, the way we got involved with the Break Free from Plastics is Valley Improvement Projects is based out of Stanislaus County in the northern San Joaquin Valley of California. And many don't know, but we're actually home to one of only two trash incinerators in the entire state of California. The other one being in Long Beach. There was recently one also in the LA area in Commerce that was shut down. And we have the only other one in the state in Stanislaus County. And it was built on the west side of the county, which, it's kind of a rural area, but there's a lot of small towns nearby. These are historically farm worker towns that have grown now, home to hundreds and thousands of people in some cases, and many of which are up to 75-80% Latino populations, many only Spanish speaking. And we all know the history of siting incinerators and other polluting sources in areas where they feel like not a lot of community members are going to come out and put up a fight about it. And it's been there since the late 80s, early 90s, and it burns 800 tons of waste every day. For a long time, we were told that, all the recycling and plastic that could be recycled gets taken out before it gets burned. And then one day we actually asked to take a tour of the facility and saw that just simply wasn't the case, that there's lots of plastics, even other types of recycling like aluminum cans, lots of cardboard and yard clippings and stuff like that, stuff that could be composted or recycled, being burned at the incinerator. And this obviously emits all kinds of hazardous stuff, from particulate matter to NOx to dioxin and other metals that are emitted from there. And although we're always told that there's limits to what can be emitted, those limits, may be low enough to say that that's all we've emitted for the day. But when you think about it, what's the result of emitting dioxin into a community for over 30 years? And that's not talked about as much. And also going along with that idea is the cumulative impacts of not only those emissions, but Highway 5, which is nearby, right down the road off of the 5 is a number of very large warehouses and distribution centers like Amazon and Restoration Hardware that bring in a lot of diesel trucks in and out. There's agriculture all around the area, pesticides that are routinely applied in the area. So what are the impacts of all of those different chemicals over decades being put in and around the same communities, which are, like I said, overwhelmingly lower moderate income, Spanish speaking, Latino, historically farm worker communities, where they choose to put these things. It's also right near the landfill. So you have emissions from the landfill, from, like I said, trucking, distribution centers, pesticides, and things like that. So that area on the west side of the county is overburdened enough. And one of the ways we've tried to raise awareness about it is pointing out the aspect that they're burning recyclable material there, including plastics, Modesto is one of the, I would say, most populated cities in California that doesn't have a basic curbside recycling program, or what we refer to as the blue bin. So we try to raise awareness about it with community members by bringing up the fact that, you know, did you ever think about why Modesto doesn't have a blue bin or recycling program like most cities our size do? And our suspicion has always been that you have this for-profit trash incinerator that needs to burn 800 tons a day. If they're not burning that much, then they're not maximizing their profits. And these facilities aren't exactly the most profitable things to begin with. So they get various subsidies and loopholes. For example, our incinerator was the only incinerator in the state where the energy they produced from burning the trash was counted as renewable energy. And that wasn't because of any, you know, scientific reason or official government definition of renewable energy. It was literally a specific carve out for our incinerator because of some political favors that where they were trying to get some more moderate Democrats in the Valley to vote for a larger environmental related bill. And that was kind of the favor that was given, was that our incinerator gets to count as renewable energy. That is not the case anymore. Us and other groups in California, especially that are near the other incinerator in Long Beach, like East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice, they advocate against their incinerator down there. And so luckily, through all of this advocacy, we got the renewable energy status taken away. And the other thing that they get is diversion credits. So if the local municipalities, like the cities and the county, are sending their waste to the incinerator, they get to count 10% of it as diverted from the landfill, which is usually meant to represent recycling, composting, reusing, things like that, not burning, because you're not really diverting it from a landfill. You're burning it and making it, in, you know, smaller and into ash, which is toxic ash, and then you're putting it in the landfill anyway. So we think that that's kind of another loophole that allows these facilities to operate. And when you do stuff like that, when you say it's renewable energy and whoever is buying that has that in their portfolio, then that means they're not getting real renewable energy. So it's kind of cheating the system. And the same with the diversion. If you're getting to count incineration as diversion, then you're not doing the real work of diverting that waste and figuring out something more sustainable to do with it. So that's always been our kind of goal with being involved in different organizations that advocate for cutting down on plastics, or doing less production of single-use plastics, and then also recycling of plastics. Is the least we could do is not be burning recyclable, reusable, compostable material. That seems like the very minimum that we can ask for if we're going to have a trash incinerator in our backyard. So anything we can do to cut down on the production of single-use plastics, the use of single-use plastics, so looking into, you know, local ordinances that cut down on the use of styrofoam and single-use plastic containers, like at restaurants and things like that, having more opportunities to recycle. We also found out that a large number or a large amount of used carpet was being burned at the incinerator. And Stanislaus County, much like our curbside recycling, we were only one of a handful of counties in the state of California that didn't have a carpet recycling drop-off place. And there's already state money that's supposed to go to making sure that there's lots of opportunity to recycle carpet.
That's okay. So as far as the letter to Congress and recommendations in the stimulus, why should waste incineration and this environmental justice issue for the communities where these incinerators are be addressed in a stimulus funding bill?
Well, it's all part of, you know, the broader notion of having a just transition. We have the way I look at it, and a lot of others, I think, look at it the same way, is we have two major issues that can be solved together. You have, obviously, with the, you know, the current pandemic is a reason for, you know, the need for a stimulus plan. But we have, you know, communities that have been suffering the effects of asthma and other respiratory problems for a long time, for decades, for generations. There's, you know, a link between the air pollution that you're exposed to and how badly you might be affected if you unfortunately were to get COVID. So those are related. And while we're going to be investing a ton of money in improving infrastructure and things like that in the country, we can't just use that money to, you know, fix up an incinerator, for example. We want to replace the incinerator with something else that provides green jobs, clean jobs for local people, but is also addressing this historical environmental justice. We're tired of kind of having the same old debate about we need jobs, and then a lot of those jobs are detrimental to the health of our community members. So we want to solve both problems by saying we do want jobs, but there are lots of new ways, new technologies available for, you know, addressing things like recycling and or not producing these single-use plastics and other plastic materials, which are eventually, you know, in communities like ours, going to be burned at an incinerator. Looking at a bill like the stimulus bill and making investments like that, then we have to be moving forward and addressing environmental justice and addressing climate change and climate justice and really trying to solve those two problems all in one.
Right. So addressing the way that we build back the lost jobs is a big part of it. And also the stimulus letter talks about federally backed loan guarantees and not promising those to plastic producers. Can you talk about that aspect of the letter?
I'm not as familiar on that aspect. Like I said, you know, I was asked to kind of be in and get involved in the conversation because of our history with the incinerator and advocating against, you know, single-use plastics and for more plastic recycling so that stuff doesn't get burned at the incinerator.
Right.
I can just say that, you know,
different question? Can you talk at all about the connection between coronavirus and environmental justice?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I kind of mentioned it before, but there's, you know, definitely a link between, obviously, between the lung health and the respiratory system health of members of our community and how badly they're going to be affected by COVID. So if you have communities that have had some of the worst air pollution in the state, or actually in the nation, in the San Joaquin Valley, and you have people that with higher rates, Latinos, for example, in the San Joaquin Valley are twice as likely to have asthma as in other places. So if you have especially vulnerable communities, like an elderly community member that has had a lifetime of, you know, having asthma or other respiratory problems, and they get COVID, that's going to deeply affect them. They might have less time to get the care that they need before they're feeling, you know, very bad effects of it, or even death, for that matter. You also, you know, kind of in a larger, more general sense, if you have folks that, you know, on a bad air day or with wildfire smoke or something like that, or have to go to the emergency room because they're having an asthma attack, then you have, you know, overloaded healthcare facilities and things like that, and you're kind of battling both of those together. The whole idea behind environmental justice is these are communities that are many times taken advantage of because it might be because they're low income working class communities. So they're busy, they're working, they're taking care of their families. They don't necessarily have time to get involved with, a process about siting a polluting facility in or near their communities. A lot of the times, especially in the Valley and in other places, there might be language access barriers. So are, information going out in Spanish or in the language that's mostly spoken in these communities and in these households? Does that just make it less likely that those community members are going to even know about the situation, much less, organize amongst themselves and go out to advocate against something like that? When you already have a community like that that's just not getting information from their local or other governments or agencies or industries, then you can see that might be the case when it comes to doing outreach around COVID, especially the word is slipping out of my head, but to keep these kinds of problems from happening in the first place, having access to healthcare, obviously, just having that relationship with local officials and local government where you know who to call and the information is in the language that you speak or read. So it's related in a direct way with the health, with the lung health of people who might get COVID. And it's just related in a more general economic way where these are communities that are just, just left out of conversations and don't have the same access to resources that other people do. I was just reading just the other day, there was an article in the Modesto Bee about how much less vaccines are being sent to counties in the San Joaquin Valley compared to like Napa County, for example, almost had twice as many vaccines as Stanislaus County and other counties in the Valley. Some of that reasoning being because of the, urban centers where there's lots of people and the infrastructure that the healthcare facilities and staff that are able to give out the vaccines. Well, that's due to a lack of investing in those kinds of healthcare infrastructure and needs, for years and years. So that's a few different ways how they're related.
Yeah. So we're out of time, Tom. I really appreciate you taking the time to tell us about what's going on in your community and to tell us about the stimulus letter. Anything else you'd like to add before we go?
No, I'm sorry that I wasn't, that I couldn't, talk more about the bill, in general. But I hope that, the information that I gave was useful.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem.